phone. So let me see if I can erase this. There we go. Hey everyone, my name is Kesting. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks for having me. I am from Big Book Magic, which is my home group. We meet in the Chelsea neighborhood in Manhattan Thursdays at 7 p.m. now. And one thing that I was told by a sponsor when I'd asked him to sponsor me, and he said, well, you need to have a home group. And I told him I had a home group, and I shared the format, right? It's based on our literature. And he said, he had a good amount of time sober. And he said, you don't know how lucky you are that you have a home group that's actually based on our literature. And when I read, like, the forwards and the preface and stuff like that, it talks about how powerful the literature is, right? Like, a book gets sent overseas, and then in the 1940s, like, it blossoms there, and we have our meetings in print, and the message is carried in a lot of different ways. And now, of course, virtual meetings, for example, is one of the ways that it's carried. But I was talking to somebody outside, like, I'm kind of tired of the virtual meetings. So it's always nice to be in person with folks. And one of the things that I say about it is I've actually never taken a newcomer to a hospital or called 911 on Zoom, but I have multiple times in person. And that's where a lot of the real work happens, and where a lot of the magic happens is in the parking lot before the meeting or after the meeting. So I am grateful to have a home group that is based in the literature, and it's wonderful to come to other groups that are based in the literature. My understanding originally was that the motif for this group was trust God, clean house, and help others, and then I got asked to come up with a theme, and so I made it up. And it's because I think it was prompted by a sponsor. He texted me, and he'd had a slip. But we'd been through the work together and the big book together, and he texted me. He said, I have this note in my book. It says the arch, and I don't know what that is. And I was kind of like, how do you not remember this, right? But for me, you know, having read this book like many, many, many times over the course of some years, and I explained to him, I'm like, oh, there's this metaphor that the author uses in the big book, talking about this new and triumphant arch through which we'll walk free people, right, once we pass through it. And there are kind of some interpretations about it, and when do you pass through it, and like, what does it look like? If you try to draw a picture, there's some things online about it. But there are some very like key places in our book that talk about it, right? And what came to mind for me was Cornerstone, Keystone. Hello, welcome. Keystone and Foundation Stone. So since I've been invited to come talk for three times, I thought I'd try to focus one on each. I may bounce around. I may not talk about all the steps and trying to keep with sort of this theme that I made up. But it's always a privilege to come to a meeting, to speak at a meeting, of course. And so for me, the cornerstone has a lot to do with coming to believe, right? And I may try to pick out some kind of quotations from the book and things like that. I don't know how much I might do that for you today. But before I do that, before I kind of talk about my experience of coming to believe and what my experience as it relates to our big book, I listen to a good amount of speaker tapes, and whenever it's a speaker I don't know, and I don't know their story, I don't know if they're alcoholic or not. And I am one of those people, right? I still carry a little bit of... I don't know if you're the same type of drinker I am, or if you're a drinker at all. So any time that I speak, I don't think there are a lot of folks here with under a year. I think probably most people have more time than I do, which is great, which is fantastic, right? But it is important for me to qualify as an alcoholic, and for me, it's most important for me to understand what type of alcoholic I am. We don't have a wonderful definition of alcoholism other than the big book, except Silkworth says, like, hey, this phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, right? Craving being, once I take one, I want more. And maybe that didn't happen every single time that I've ever drank, right? That may be in working with somebody else, trying to guide them through this process of, are you an alcoholic? They may or may not know that, right? And part of my job as an informed AA member, right, to share what AA is and what AA is not, is to give them the dignity and grace to figure that out. And we have some great tools to do that. I get to share my experience with them. I use the literature and then pose questions to them and some considerations that they can kind of take and ask themselves those questions. But it's been very important for me to know what type of alcoholic I am. You know, I'm that chronic type that's talked about in the big book, and it's not something I really had to grapple with when I accepted it and I knew it. That has not ever left me since. I'm going to mention the 12 and 12 real quick. Don't hurt me, right? But the only step that we have to take at the 100% level for a lot of us. At least that was my experience with it. And since I had that first step experience in 2009, where I realized that I was beyond human aid from staying stopped, and I would always drink again, and once I drink, I'm screwed and I'm off to the races, and I was beyond human aid, but I didn't believe in any kind of God, I didn't believe in any kind of higher power, and it was not a hopeful step. It was a feeling of complete hopelessness, and I entirely broke down, and I remember that moment pretty well. And that's never left me. I have not, since that time, thankfully, and I'm not saying it couldn't come back, right, because alcoholism is coming baffling and powerful, of course. But since that time, I haven't really had that consideration where I'm like, maybe I could have one or two, or maybe I could smoke a little bit of dope or do this or that. And so I'm very grateful for that, where I had an experience where I gained an incredible amount of clarity on it. I'm only going to give a few examples when it comes to my alcoholism. I did things very backwards growing up. And I didn't discover alcohol till a little bit later. I'd been doing a bunch of other things, and by the time I was 16 years old, I had a terrifying intravenous drug problem. And I remember that really that it wasn't necessarily my first drink ever, where I like drank to the point that I got sick. But someone introduced vodka to me that's not mixed with something, and they're like, "Here, chase it with this." And I really remember that like inviting warmth that I got. Like I got that effect quickly this time. Not like those other handful of times where a little vodka and Coke or rum and Coke or something like that. And I said, this is socially acceptable. This is cheap. This is wonderful. And I can pursue this with a real enthusiasm, I thought. Though at that time in high school, to scrape up that $8 a day was sometimes difficult to get that fifth. But I really took off with alcohol quite quickly, And the chronic nature of my alcoholism is quite evident in looking at how many treatment centers have I been to? How many hospitals have I been to? How many psych wards have I been to? How many sober livings have I been to? How many times, most importantly, right, it's not that number, right, which is like 25 to 30 or something like that. Most importantly is how many times have I really, really had a sincere desire to stop and stay stopped and not been able to? Because I would come to these rooms and I'd hear about, like, don't drink no matter what. I'm like, hey, great message to say, hey, don't consider that an option. Go to a meeting, call someone, do something else other than that. Don't entertain that. But that alone didn't supply the power that I needed in order to stay stopped, very simply. So I have a starting again problem, and I speak probably 2 to 4 times a month. I get to speak at H&I, at least. And I spend a lot of time on that first step. I spend a lot of time on that first step because if I believe what our book tells me, right, is one alcoholic can secure the confidence of another alcoholic like no non-alcoholic can, you know, that hook is tremendously important. So I spend a lot of time doing that, and I understand, like, there was a time where I'd go to meetings and I hear a speaker and I heard about, too much of the drunkologue or this or that. And I kind of realized today that, like, maybe that speaker wasn't for me that night. Maybe it was for somebody else in that room, perhaps who, is struggling whether to figure out if they're alcoholic or not, or need to be reminded of it that night. Because I'm also somebody who's gotten away from this program several times before after having had an experience, after this cornerstone, right, gets fixed firmly in place, and gone back out for one reason or another. A lot of that related to 6 and 7, a lot of that related to just becoming so far removed from the program, thinking that I'm going to be okay because I haven't thought about a drink in a long time. And then next thing I know, right, I've lost everything again, and I'm back in the cups of very unlovely creature getting drunk and loaded again. So it's always been tremendously important for me to do that, and I can kind of just maybe hopefully sum it up, and without going through like what all the consequences were, but the internal consequences I think are what matter the most, that have the most import and influence, right? And a lot of the rest of my willingness in taking these steps is informed by that first step that I had. Because that's a lot of where that gift of desperation comes from. For me in the past has been, I don't like the way this feels. Right? And I didn't necessarily have to find a sponsor who had what I wanted. I didn't like what I had anymore. But the thing that that very first sponsor I worked with did have, and I think I'll share a little bit about this as it relates to the theme, was he experienced what a lot of you may refer to or will refer to as the 10-step promises. And I'd heard, you know, the 9-step promises a bunch of times in, you know, in meetings and things like that. You know, the whole, like, you know, we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness and financial insecurity will leave me. I'll intuitively know how to handle situations with you. These are all great things, and a lot of which I've experienced. Wonderful things. But my idea of recovery for a long time was that I'm going to come to go to treatment, go here, go somewhere else, and try to stay connected to something and find something that works. But those times where that suffering obsession returns, I'm going to have to white knuckle it and get through it and call people and things like that. And that didn't really attract me as a sober way of life. I'm not saying it can't happen whether you're sober a long time or not a long time. I desperately wanted to drink probably for most of my first year and was suicidal for a lot of it. It was hard coming back this time around. But my feet continued to move. I continued to do the things. And you know, I'm more connected to and busier today than I was in my first few years where it was a real struggle. And stayed sober by a lot of grace in that way. But very simply, as far as this first step is, there's no amount of self-knowledge I've been able to obtain that gives me the power to stay stopped. There's no amount of willpower, and in fact, the progression of my alcoholism was my willpower became weakened and weakened over a period of years where there really was very, very little defense at all in terms of saying, like, no to that first one. And there's really no fear of consequence. There was one period, I went out after a few years, like in the early 2010s, and then really, really struggled to make it back. And I was very angry with God during this time. I was very angry with God during this time that, you know, I'd had an experience with these steps and just couldn't understand why there are certain things that hadn't happened in my life. And it was just very resentful and resentful at myself, right? Full of a lot of that remorse that we speak about. And of course, like, ended up, I got asked, like, hey, would you like to go to the shelter or the Alana Club? I got kicked out of a sober living. I was maybe like 2 or 3 weeks sober. And I didn't want to go to a shelter. And I said, take me to the Alana Club. So I had garbage bags full of stuff. And, you know, I slept in the bushes, I think, that night with that. But what I did before sleeping in the bushes was I had every intention on drinking. I had absolutely every intention on drinking. And I went and bought a bottle of, I think it was Evan Williams. Like, not a fancy whiskey, but I had $20 where I could get an Evan Williams and I got a tall boy. And I'm the kind of drunk where I like to have all my things and everything set up first. But that wasn't what happened so much that night. Was I was scared to drink. And I didn't think that, like, I had the power to say no or anything like that, but I was truly scared to drink because this other part of my, this first step that occurred for me on that night was I realized that I had absolutely no idea what was going to happen once I took that first one. Because previously I had this notion that perhaps I could control the consequences a little bit, right? Because I tried to die many times, and what happened very strikingly is I realized there are outcomes worse than death for me in alcoholism. And it's going in and out of these rooms for decades. And I was afraid I was going to become one of those people. And I've known those people. I've known some of those people very, very well. And to do this for another 40 years, I've been desperately trying to die and couldn't. So fear of consequences couldn't keep me sober either. But I realized for me at a certain point that I really had no control over what those consequences would be. Because I might have a plan. I might have a plan. And it never seemed to work out that way. So to return to kind of this theme of the cornerstone, I'm kind of curious, like, where does this idea of coming to believe sort of appear in the book. And I think it's really apropos. One of the times in the books this is I came to believe is Dr. Bob. And there are things that I really appreciate more about his story, being sober a little bit longer. But he had this belief that I absolutely believed as well. We're like, hey, I came to believe that alcohol is going to be the panacea for all my ills. Right? And he kind of said that. And when I discovered liquor, right, and of course, like Bill talks about, like the excitement, and I arrived, and all of those things. Like I had absolutely a spiritual experience with alcohol, and a lot of these other things that I was doing, and I would pursue with a real enthusiasm anything that got me out of myself. Alcohol tended to be right up at the top of that list with me. And I absolutely did live by a certain amount of faith in that. I had faith that I was going to experience some sort of effect once I had that first drink. Whether it was I wanted to attempt to party or to numb some sort of psychic pain that I was experiencing emotionally, whether it was jealousy, anger, all of these things that are talked about in our literature, I placed a lot of faith in that. But what was being asked of me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I look at these shades on the wall with these 12 steps and they're talking about God, right? And they're using pronouns like he and him and talking about spirituality, spiritual awakening. And, you know, I came in as, you know, the unbeliever, eternal skeptic, whatever you want to call it. I simply could not get on board with this sort of program. I really wish I had a better answer for why some people get it and some people don't get it. I sometimes get that question. I can share from my experience, right? But I had a friend share a few years ago, and this makes so much sense to me now, though I don't think I would have had the faculty to think of it on my own, that his experience was two things needed to be present. Right? And this absolutely matches some, maybe not all of my experience, but is that desire from that's some sort of change, or at least willingness for some sort of change, right? And that change, you know, probably a lot of the time is going to be, I don't want to live this way anymore. I don't want to drink like this anymore, right? Maybe I'm one of those people who can't safely drink at all. And that other thing is that solution needs to be presented at the same time. I've had many of those moments. Right, desperately wanted to stay stopped, and there wasn't like a sponsor there, or I wasn't at a meeting or something like that. And there were plenty of times I went to meetings and I probably had well-informed members of AA come up to me afterward and say, hey, can I get your number? Or would you, you know, are you looking for a sponsor? Is there some way that I could be helpful to you? That I was like, no thanks, you're very weird. Why are you talking to me? I thought it was odd. I really, really did think it was odd. For a while. So both of those things needed to happen. And fortunately for me, I'm somebody who's been afforded probably 32 plus second chances. I understand not everybody gets one second chance. There are probably those out there, I would imagine, who never get any chance, right? And that's truly sad. And it is important for us to keep the doors open for that person, whether it's their first chance or second chance or 85th chance. It doesn't really matter. So I couldn't get on board with the whole God or spirituality thing. I grew up in an atheist household. My father had a lot of academic pride. I'm sure he still does, though he's kind of chilled out a little bit today. Where, you know, I did not follow that path, but he's extremely proud of me, and I have like a pretty decent relationship with my parents today. And that's been a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps, right? Where I've had a restoration of a lot of those relationships, and or at least gone out and done my part to try and rectify anything that I could. And the way that I sum up that ninth step that I may not talk about a whole lot, but I got posed these three R's, right? Express remorse, take responsibility, make restitution. And I kind of just sums it up for me really, really well. I didn't make that up. I think it's great. I use it all the time. So what did change? And when I was talking about that moment where I had that first step experience where I realized that I was absolutely screwed and I was 100% hopeless apart from some sort of, you know, like intercession or divine help or something, but that I didn't believe in, I think in that moment I became willing to try anything, including really doing Alcoholics Anonymous, because before that, there was a time where I went to a lot of meetings. You know, I think for about 3 months, I went to a ton of meetings. I probably went to like 2 or 3 a day. But that was really the extent of what I was doing, was I was just going to meetings. And I got an opportunity actually to speak at the clubhouse that I used to frequent a lot in Manhattan. And I got to speak there on Friday. And what I said was, I used to just come here for the stories. As soon as somebody talked about like the Big Book or the steps or spot, you know, I really just, my mind would clasp shut when I'd hear those things, because that's fine and well for you, but I just love coming for the stories. And the worse the story was, the more I was magnetized to that. And I still love stories today, whether it's in Alcoholics Anonymous or somewhere else, and I get to do stuff, you know, 40 plus hours a week that allows me to continue to hear stories, and I really enjoy that. So the things that kept me coming back or in place, going to the meetings early on, aren't necessarily the things at all that keep me coming back here today. The things I was attracted to initially are certainly not what I'm attracted to today when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I go back to that meeting, and the perspective I have on that is like, I'm not coming to this meeting for me, right? The perspective I have is, you know, hopefully I get to share something here and maybe talk to some people afterward. Perhaps I can be helpful instead. And it's certainly not a meeting I would want to go to in order for me to write. And that's not to take the inventory of any meeting or any clubhouse or anything like that. It's just that experience I've had where there have been periods of transition in my sobriety, right? And those people that I've needed to meet along the way have consistently presented themselves, and I've had to be open to new things and perhaps new groups and new sponsors. And being somebody who's gotten sober more than a few times and having sponsors actually go back out as well, I've had a lot of different experiences, not just with our book, but with the steps and with making amends and exploring other literature and the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and all of these things. And it's become much more broad for me. And I will say, there was a time where I used to be quite rigid when it came to First Legacy. First Legacy just meaning 12 steps. And I'm so much less rigid today, in part because of Second and Third Legacy. And I'm just a lot happier that way as well. So I'm rarely perturbed by it. So there's something that happened in those initial meetings, but I certainly hadn't come to a place. You know, of course, going to meetings for me did not work. I didn't really fellowship either. I know some people, the fellowship is a powerful force and a necessary part for me. I need to have God steps and fellowship in my life and my program in order for this to continue to work. It's been my experience. But when I had that moment where I knew I was willing to actually try something, like actually get a sponsor. And for me, I had to leave New York City, and people were like, that's a great idea, get out of here. And I got a lot of my AA in Arizona. I want to see if there's anything as far as this cornerstone that I may have noted. No, not right now. The fifth edition, like they're collecting story, or they've already collected, you missed the deadline if you're thinking about writing. And sorry, that just happened on Halloween. If you're thinking, man, someone really needs to hear my story. But it's a wonderful play. And I got sober this time. I was very, very hopeless. I did not know if I wanted to get sober. And I remember reading the stories in the back of the book. Actually, in all 4 editions, they had a copy of Experience, Strength, and Hope, and of course the 4th edition. I read all those stories while I was there for those 22 days. And a lot of those stories, I was like, ah, this is trash. All that means is that it wasn't for me, right? But there were those stories where I was like, okay, maybe I have a chance, right? And that's exactly what happens in the room, whether it's with a sponsor or whether you're listening to someone speak. And I didn't coin this at all, really, but because we are a storytelling society, like that transfer of faith that starts to happen really happens at that individual level a lot of the time. Some people might be reading the book, right? Probably most of the time that's not the case. It is a difficult book for me. The first time I read it cover to cover, every line spoke to me in a way where I said, this finally answers all these questions I had no idea about. And of course, my understanding, appreciation, and love for it has enlarged over the years, and I really kind of envision it as like a diamond, where if you kind of shift it a little bit and the light refracts differently off of it, and I see something else, I see something new, I see it in a different light. So in these stories that they're collecting and things like that, they're really looking for that moment where something happened. And if you read the stories from any of the editions now, a lot of the time you can kind of pinpoint that, or you know, you go to a convention, and you hear someone's story, you might hear that moment where something happened. For some people that's really clear, for others it's not clear. For me, I don't really have that moment where like something happened this time around. But something did happen really that first time around, where I met another drunk who our backgrounds were entirely different. He was, I'm not short, but he was 6'4", shaved head, covered in tattoos, neck down to his toes, from Arizona, different political background, different family background, educational background. Everything was different except for the fact that I really, really identified with his inability to stay stopped from drinking and putting needles in his arms. And he had 13 months. Now, a lot of the time, like, I went and spoke at a detox yesterday, and a guy that I sponsored briefly, who I got from there, was there again. He disappeared. He was in there again. And I talked to him after the meeting. He's like, man, you really should go around and show your pictures of what you looked like 7 years ago. Because they look at you now, and they're like, they can't see that, right? And I realized that, you know, it's great to have this diversity, not just in stories and people who are in Alcoholics Anonymous, but also sobriety times, too. It's great. Bring someone with 90 days. Bring someone with maybe 60 days, or, you know, different areas do that differently. Because I didn't look at this man back in 2009 and go, oh, he's only sober 13 months. I went, oh my God, how do you have 13 months? I'd never been able to get anything like a year. Just never been able to do that, right? Talk about the wet test and the dry test. That's the dry test, right? And so he was able to speak to my heart in a way that no other non-alcoholic could, because for me, that was really one of those cornerstones. And I think for a lot of us, we have that experience with, maybe it was a speaker, maybe it was a moment reading something, or just when you're out there. I don't know. A lot of these, you know, we talk about, and we'll talk about it probably in a few weeks, talking about having had a spiritual awakening or spiritual experience as a result of these steps. Historically, and people I know well, and have had these powerful, powerful experiences, not always as a result of taking these 12 steps, but as a result of that complete deflation that they experience. And that opens some sort of channel for them to be open to something. And then maybe they make some real change, right? And they join like a 12-step program, for example, or something has shifted of significance. So at this point, like, I'm no longer in charge of my recovery. I was staying in a double wide trailer in Arizona. I thought I was going to like the mecca of young people recoveries. This was in 2009. I was 22. The town I was in was not the mecca of young people recovery, and the average sober length of time is probably 20 years. So I got sober with a bunch of long timers, and I loved it. I personally have just never really related to YPOS much, but loved them, and have gone to some of those conventions and things as well, just to experience their enthusiasm. So I was ready to take direction, but I still have that powerful sentiment that I'm not going to make it. You know, as much as I want this to work, as desperately and as willing as I am, I don't believe that I'm someone who can believe. And we don't all come in there with that. In the beginning of We Agnostics in chapter 4 shares that, hey, something like half of us may come in who are really of that agnostic or atheist temperament. And I was one of those, and I've gotten to sponsor some people who come in who are very devout, know a lot more about organized religion than I do. And they're coming to me for help because there's obviously something that I'm doing that's working, right? And I realized recently there's a speaker who's been saying this for years. I thought I made it up, right? It's the faith without works is dead, but it's also work without faith. Faith is dead, right? And so a lot of those situations where I sponsor someone who's very, very religious, they got that faith piece, but it's not followed by any kind of action, right? And so I've had to have both of those things. And I remember being in the Subway trailer. I was there with this. I wish I could find a speaker tape of him. He wasn't like a phenomenal speaker, but I loved listening to him. But he got sober in Southern California, and he and Clancy didn't get along, which I thought was really funny because they were both like really, really hard-lined AAs, and they didn't get along at all. But I got sober with this, and he was dying. He was on hospice, right? And I walk in that first day. I got on a bus from New York City to Arizona. And I walk in, right, I think I'm going to the young people mecca of AA out in Arizona, and I walk in with this double wide trailer, and there's this long timer, like, in a wheelchair with hoses in his nose and stuff like that, and I'm like, this is not what I was expecting at all. And I think he had, you know, as he was approaching his time, he wasn't necessarily as hard-lined as he used to be, right? And the man had some glaring defects, and he'd be the first to admit that, and we'd all laugh about it together, right? Because we could see it, and he would recognize it, go, oh, there I go again, right? And he was very human. And he was a very good example for me as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's been sober a long time, who was very human, could admit that, could share that. And for him, his sort of philosophy was he treated meetings as kind of like little mini fifth steps, right? And I know for some people that may sound absurd or not for them, and that's okay, but that was kind of the way he treated it. He'd go to a meeting and he'd sort of tell on himself. And, you know, right, this shared limitation we all have of not being not God. Thank you, Ernie Kay, for that, right? Really, I'm not going to mention the book, but some of you may know the book. And I remember one night I was with him. It was kind of late. And I don't know if I was trying to get a rise out of him or something, or for him to confirm this belief that I couldn't make it. And I kept saying, you don't understand, this just isn't going to work for me. And his response repeatedly was, just keep doing what you're doing. Because he knew something at that time that I didn't know. Was I didn't have to believe in anything. I didn't have to have that cornerstone at that moment. I just had to keep doing what I was doing, continue on with this process and taking the steps, and he knew I was going to be okay. And there wasn't any kind of wavering for it. He said some things that I understand today that I didn't understand at the time, and he said, I'm being a very good example to you dying sober, because, you know, as ill as he was, you know, he was offered, you know, morphine and stuff like that. I found there was morphine in the house, and like, hey, sign me up. I like morphine just fine, you know. Wasn't what I was doing regularly, but, you know, before, but it works. I don't know. And he did die sober. He actually died on a way to a meeting we were going to together. About a week before that, he'd made, I guess, like another amends to his ex-wife, who I got to know a little bit. And he told me like a week before, he's like, I clean house with my ex. I'm ready to go. I'm excited to go into the next room and play, right? So he was a very good example for me in terms of dying sober. And I understand what he meant that day. It's not that he couldn't have used that morphine or anything like that. He just thought it was more important to see somebody die with some grace and do it clear-headed, right? He wasn't in that much pain where he absolutely had to have it, right? So a lot of these things have happened throughout my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that I understand better now. And it's interesting, I think, just speaking in general. Oh my God, I've talked for a long time and haven't done anything. Okay. just speaking in general, where the way that I'll tell one of these stories now is like, you know, we try to do it with some sort of, some sort of weight to it, right? Where it can really be heard and received, and I think Bill Wilson's writing is a very good example of that, where like the truth behind it is perhaps a bit messier, right? But it's about like what's the actual message going on there. And there are these powerful messages that I look back on it now and I go, like, wow, that's something that I get to carry and sometimes that I get to share. Because I promise you, the way that I talk about some of these events, if I talked about them 10 years ago, is not the same way that I talk about them today. And if I talk about some of the experiences I had there in drinking and some of the horrific stuff I had and how terribly I treated my family, it still can be a real, real pain. My mother wouldn't tell those stories the same way that I tell them today, right? Or I talk about a first step experience where I talk about like physically fighting with her over a bottle of vodka and begging for money on the street. Like, she still carries a lot of hurt around that. She's not a member of Al-Anon or anything else. She's a good woman who's, you know, done her best as a mother and as a wife, and I think on balance has been phenomenal. Right? So the way that we tell stories is very, very, very interesting for me. So one thing that was emphasized, and this is talked about in our book really frequently, right? And in my view, if we had nothing other than Bill's story in chapter one, we'd have a program of recovery. It's an example of the problem and an example of the solution. Do we have like some sort of column way to do an inventory? Like, no, right? It's not super organized in there, but I'm sure people would make it up. We're doing a moral inventory. What does moral mean? It means right or wrong, right? So I really believe that about that story, that it contains our program of recovery in a somewhat comprehensive way. And in step two in it, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. They talk about a foundation, and there are a few times in the book that talk about a foundation, right? And we're turning to that metaphor of this arch I was talking about. And in case I don't get to it, what is a cornerstone? I sometimes get that question. And like, not a mason, I like will tell you, not a mason. But if I have this arch, like there are these cornerstones where they meet the ground. That's my understanding of it. Okay. And so what was expressed to me repeatedly was, it doesn't have to be this Christian kind of God that you might, you know, think it is based on these other books or what other people say in meetings or anything like that. And it doesn't have to be Buddha. It doesn't have to be any of these things. That it can be your own conception, right? Why don't you consider your own conception of God? And that's kind of the second step that happens there. Belief in this is page 13 to 14, belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were essential requirements. So I knew this was not optional. I needed to be willing to believe in something. Now, the way I read the big book is, I at least was really encouraged by that piece of literature and my sponsor to try to have a personal relationship, even though I didn't believe in anything, have a personal relationship with some sort of power greater than myself. I think that hoop became very widened with the 12 and 12, which I think is great. Like, but I didn't come in practicing this thinking I'm going to make the group my higher power, because I knew I was just screwed. I'm not saying the group isn't a higher power. In fact, I think it is, right? Where is that higher power expressed? Boy, our second tradition right there. And then maybe that group business meeting, right? The feeling have shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in and of itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. Now we're talking about cement, right? We're talking about this foundation. We'll get more clear on that foundation when we talk about that fifth step, when it talks about the first five proposals, which is just steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. I guess that's the foundation. That's my best guess on reading our book, is that's the foundation here. I don't want to read that now. So I want to make sure I get to this, because this is, I think, where the cornerstone is actually mentioned in chapter 4. It says, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. It's 47. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure them that they're on their way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So in case there's any confusion, this is not a real arch we're building. You should not be in the backyard of the sponsor building an arch. It's a spiritual structure. I really love how later in the chapter they give an example of what this looks like. And this is really, for me, what the theme of the cornerstone is. And I think there's... Okay, I think it's like page 56 to 57. We're given an example of someone having a spiritual experience, right? And it's actually for the history lovers, it's Fitz M. who's being spoken about here. It said, this man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude, just something that shakes it up, has shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away that very night years ago. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of a drink has never returned. At such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him, right? And basically sober. So what's being communicated to me here, at least the way that I read this, is we can have this cornerstone, which is just being willing to believe, right? And, okay, I got step two, right? Doesn't matter whether I believe in anything or not. I can go ahead and take step three to the best of my ability, even if it's just saying, hey, I'm going to do what you tell me to do. I'm going to turn my will and my life over to something else, even if that's Alcoholics Anonymous today or the direction that my sponsor is giving me as it relates to this program. But when is that cornerstone really fixed in place? And I think it has to do with some sort of spiritual awakening, some sort of spiritual experience that happens, right? This is Fitz's story. It's our Southern friend. I don't think he really talks about it in the story itself. So the point being for me, and I'm not going to talk about it today, I did not come to believe until I had an experience. I had this cornerstone, right? I'm willing to believe, but I didn't come to believe until something actually happened. I had a lot of conversations with people. I read this book and other AA literature and outside literature, of course. It wasn't something that I could ever intellectualize or think myself into. It is fun to have this be an intellectual exercise a little bit, right? And it's fun to be a big book technician for a few minutes, right? And go, this and this is what it means. And that. All that stuff's wonderful because it keeps us engaged in recovery as long as I don't get stuck there. Right? Because it's very easy to get rigid and stuck in first legacy recovery, is my experience. But it didn't matter until I had an experience with this. Right? I can say spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, all I want. And the great news is that looks different for different people. You can't have my experience. You've got to go out there and have your own experience with this thing. And again, I'm not going to talk too much about spiritual awakening, but just as far as the simplicity, second printing of the first edition, March 1941, we add the second appendix. It wasn't titled Appendix 2, is just spiritual experience. It kind of explained, like, hey, this might just be a personality change that, in fact, other people notice before you do. But there's been some real change that's taken place, right? And I can be conscious of grace or not conscious of grace, but that grace can still be there. Let's see if there's anything else that I want to share on here. Not particularly on that. So by the time I got to this third step, it was that. I didn't believe in anything. I did not believe in anything, but I was willing to continue on and take the direction and do that third step prayer. And that relates to the keystone part of the theme, and I will talk more about that certainly next week. But I got to say, for me, that cornerstone was just being willing. And it wasn't firmly put in place until I actually had an experience. And that's still true for me today. Let's set aside the problem of alcoholism. Right? That problem's been removed from me today. It can come back. I've had that experience where that suffering obsession returns. It can come back. It can absolutely come back. Right? Especially if I get away from this. More than likely to come back. But what about these other problems that I have? Right? Especially if I'm not willing to invite counsel from others, or using these tools that I have, like prayer and meditation, or inviting God into those matters, right? I may not have any kind of faith or trust whatsoever when it comes to trying to solve these other problems. And in fact, I may not have an experience with it where I come to believe that, hey, perhaps God can guide me to whatever outcome is supposed to happen, until I start to have some experiences that reflect that. And I start to have some experiences where it's like, whoa, all that financial insecurity I had before, it turned out okay. In fact, I thought it was really bad news when later on I found, like, thank God that happened, because perhaps there would have been this other outcome if it hadn't. But I don't always know if something is good or whether something is bad, especially in that moment. I got a job I thought I was a shoo-in for late last year, and I didn't get it. And I didn't know why, and I was really confused about it. And now I know, because 4 months later, I got a job, and I'm like, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And it's in the same company, it's just doing a totally different thing. So, it is 7:23, and I know we're leaving early today. Thank you. Thanks for having me. So I would love to hear what you have to say on, I guess as far as the theme would be, anything second step related or cornerstone or however the spirit moves you, but I'm not one for like a check-in on your sobriety kind of person. Thank you.